9 to noon every weekday. It is Amy Marks Kors and Chris Ranji. If you're just tuning in, good morning and hello. Glad you're with us today. We are now going to the guest line. Partner and managing director of One Private Wealth, Dave Simons, who is a regular contributor to KMOX over the years and with us now, as there are all kinds of financial issues that we need to talk about. Dave, how you doing?
Well, you know, trying to stay cool like everybody else, Chris. It is a little tough out there.
Yeah, so what sort of stocks do you need to buy to make some quick money so you can pay your energy bill?
Yeah, the day traders, if they're successful, I guess that's the way to do it. But holy cow, it's tough.
Yeah, and I know you focus on stocks and longer term investments. But Dave, how often are you talking to a client who, you know, trying to make things work with investments, but then gets hit with unexpected expenses like, you know, electric bill that went up from $100 a month to $450 a month, or a medical issue where suddenly they don't seem to have a comfortable cash flow?
Yeah, Amy, that's why it's so important for people to make sure they have emergency savings. When I talk to newer and younger investors in particular, so like young adult kids of clients, and they'll come to me and say, hey, I would like to start a stock portfolio like you've helped my parents all these years. And I said, okay, great. How much do you have in emergency savings? So if you quickly need to buy four new tires, or your car insurance, because you're young, is probably going to go up and you're going to be off your parents' insurance soon. And they kind of look at me and go, well, you know, I got about $800. I'm like, okay, there's no stock investing for you. And so, Amy, I always tell people, like, minimum emergency savings, you really should get into that 8 to 10 grand just in cash, put it into some money market. After that, everybody's going to be a little bit different. Some people would say, well, you should have even more than that. For example, a full year of income. Wow. Put aside. Yeah. Well, a lot of people can't quite get to that. So I start with the thing that you just referenced: higher electric bills, food inflation, need new tires, or a medical emergency. Have that first.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to ask you a question based on how I know that 60% of the people, maybe more, are in their cars right now and heard you say you need to have $8,000 to $10,000 ready to go in an emergency fund. How many people heard you say that and went, what?
No doubt.
I don't have $8,000 to $10,000 just laying around. I guarantee you. So what if you're that, what do you do?
Yeah, Chris, because you're exactly right. Because every survey, poll, study that I've seen shows that at least half, if not 60%, using the percentage that you use, can't. If they had to come up, and I think the number was like $1,000, it wasn't a huge number, could not come up with it. And so that's really tough for people who have to live paycheck to paycheck. And I know a lot of people listening to us right now, they're in that boat. And so this is, they know that they need to save, but they're saying, Dave, I don't know how I can do it with this inflation and my income hasn't kept up with it. There's not a lot that I can advise that all of a sudden there's a magic pill, other than, look, and this could be some tough medicine for people, so I don't mean to step on some toes, but the times that I will sit down with some folks, and it's usually, again, these are the emerging adults, I would say, who are probably living a little bit above their means. That's not everybody. I'm not criticizing everybody that doesn't have the $1,000, but I'm telling you, a lot of people will say, yeah, maybe I didn't need to take that trip to Italy to see my best friend get married last month. Maybe I could have kept from purchasing that particular new bike because I love to bike. There is a way, if you can live really, really frugally, that you can at least get to a few $1,000s. It can happen, but it takes sacrifice.
Hey, Dave, this was a phrase that I heard when I was younger, like way too young to be thinking about buying a house because it was pre-housing crisis, pre-2008. But one of the phrases I heard a lot was like the phrase house poor. like where someone really stretches themselves to buy a McMansion or, you know, a big house, and then they couldn't furnish it, or maybe they couldn't get a new car or couldn't go on vacations. But I feel like I don't hear that phrase anymore. Have Americans changed the way they view buying homes, or am I just out of the loop?
No, I think you're exactly right, Amy. I think it is really since the Great Recession and housing prices crumbled and so many people got burned. I knew one family that purchased a bigger house than they really could have afforded, and their curtains, their drapes were newspapers.
Oh.
And I just thought, come on. Yeah. And you know what? And not to cast aspersions at the mortgage or lending industry, but if you've ever been through the process, a lot of times they'll sit down and say, okay, based on what I've seen here with your assets and your income, you can afford this house. And I'm thinking, no, I can't. I'm not doing that.
Right.
And so you typically have to back off a little bit, and it's the old keep up with the Joneses. So I think you're right, Amy. I don't think it's the house poor anything, but you know, one thing that I do see, there's a lot more travel stuff that's happening now. I see this with my own kids who are 28 and, she'll be 31 this Friday. And I'm thinking, holy cow, I didn't even take a vacation till I was 28 years old and married. And it was I drove to Colorado. And I even, not to the old get out the small violin, but talk about sacrifice. My first job out in Kansas, I had an old beat up 75 Ford LTD that I sold and rode a bike to work in my one suit that I had for an entire year. And I know young people, a lot will make sacrifices, but I don't know. I don't get a sense that the sacrifices are nearly the same as generations before.
So
that's a good point.
Before we move on, yeah. I just want to make sure, are you saying that you're not supposed to have newspaper curtains?
Send me some pictures. I'll help you with that, Chris.
Okay.
I'd always heard that your house, like if you furnish it accordingly, like it's a lot of times it's 20%. The furnishing, the decorating is going to cost you 20%
of what the house costs.
Of what the house cost.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
Well,
yeah.
I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's the, where'd you get that one?
You know how expensive draperies are? Well,
apparently that's why I've gotten newspapers in my house.
I'm just thinking, like, I believe it. I'm like, I mean, I moved to a tiny house. It couldn't be any smaller. My apartment, my old apartment was bigger than my house, but I like it. But I mean, every time you buy a piece of furniture or you buy curtains, it is expensive.
It is.
These ancillary costs.
Dave, what do we expect to have happen with interest rates?
Well, I think it's the consensus is definitely when the Fed, and they're meeting today, but they'll announce it tomorrow afternoon, that they will not tinker with rates. So we are all really waiting to see what the language is going forward. And it's really going to be between hawkish and dovish. Hawkish meaning, no, we are not raising rates anytime soon. Don't even think about it. To dovish saying, hey, you know what? We're going to send out the hint now that we could start lowering rates in September. That's sort of what Wall Street is voting on. So I think the market will do okay if that's what happens. But if they act like they're still not interested and don't even think about it, everybody, maybe not for the rest of this year, the markets will not like that and they'll tank tomorrow and Thursday. But I don't think we're going to go there. I've said this before. I think the Fed really should start lowering rates now. But I think by September they will.
What about inflation? Because I'm actually hearing some pretty positive things about the market and the economy in general. And it's funny because I feel like everything's really expensive and that's not going to change.
Yeah, you know why? It's that cumulative effect, Amy, because when you have prices go up, they don't come down again, except for things like oil and gas. That fluctuates wildly. But clothing prices, auto prices, anything else, you know, most of our food prices, if they go incrementally higher, it's not like they go back down to where they were 5 years ago. They're stuck. And so it's this feeling like, wow, things are so expensive. But what I look at is just the year over year. And right now, inflation is running at about 2.7%. We'll get the latest monthly number, the newest one here in a couple of days. But the Fed funds rate, which is what the Fed looks at, is between 4.25% and 4.5%. So there's this gap. That's why a lot of people like myself say, wait a minute, your interest rates that you're keeping up here are quite a bit higher than where inflation is. Inflation, folks, Jay Powell, is giving you some cover now to please start moving that down. The housing market, man, is stuck. Not so much here in St. Louis. It's okay. But a lot of markets are really, really struggling and flat. And we're seeing some big price reductions because people are not wanting to lock in 7%. We need to unlock that for this economy to continue to move forward.
All right.
I am having the worst time with my microphone button. I keep
button
hitting it three times and it wouldn't start. Anyway, so Dave, unemployment come Friday. We just saw a report that job openings fell. So how are these two things going to relate to each other?
Yeah, there are a number. It's interesting because there are a number of employment related figures that come out during the week. We get this ADP number, which also goes into unemployment. It's also a number, Chris, that you just cited about job openings. That doesn't typically move the market much. Everyone's waiting for this Friday number to come out to say, where is unemployment? You know, it's been hovering in that low 4% range. I don't expect to see any big surprises. Maybe it slightly ticks up a tenth of a percent. I think that's okay. This is interesting about following economics and how it relates to the stock market. Good or bad news can sometimes be good news. If the unemployment rate on Friday all of a sudden goes up much higher than expected, you could see the market rally. And the reason is because, oh my goodness, the economy is weakening. That means the Fed really is going to have to cut rates, and they're going to do it more aggressively than we want. Mortgage rates are going to come down. They now have to spur the economy on. So you could see a market rally if we get a really bad number. I don't think we are. I think we're in that sanguine kind of lazy summer period now where the market will probably meander here for just a little bit.
All right, Dave Simons, we love talking to you, and we appreciate you. We do this every Tuesday at 10 o'clock. So how about next Tuesday at 10 o'clock?
I think we can do that. I will be talking to you. I hate to rub this in, but from the cool Colorado mountains.
Oh, my gosh. That's
yes.
The best place in the world. You can ask your wife about the 20% decorating thing.
Well, I think she might be pushing the 30%, so maybe I'll ask someone else.
Oh, also, Dave, you know how much money you could have saved if you didn't go to Colorado?
Oh, my gosh.
He's older than 28 now, though.
Oh, that's right.
Well, I am.
Honestly.
But you could be a financial planner with that kind of thinking, Chris. That's very good.
Well, and I was thinking, if my financial planner doesn't have enough money at this stage of life to go to Colorado, maybe I shouldn't be talking to him.
Oh, good point. That's a great point. You know, it's funny you say that real quick. I've always told other advisors starting out, there's a fine line.
Yeah.
You don't want to act really poor because people are going to think, well, you obviously aren't even good at doing this for your own self.
Right.
But you don't want to be wearing a Rolex and driving a Bentley either.
Yep.
Because you make way too much money on your clients. Just live moderately and modestly.
Thank you,
that's
Dave.
That's my motto for the day.
That's the title of our show, Moderate and Modest.
That's the title of my life.
Yeah. Very good.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, guys, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week.
You too.
Dave Simons, partner and managing director at One Private Wealth. It is the Chris and Amy show, and a baseball great passed away last night, a Cardinals rival, in fact, and we will talk about that when we come back on KMOX.
Sandberg had four hits Thursday, including a home run, had three hits yesterday against the Cardinals, and the payoff. Line drive, base hit. Dernier rounds third. Zimmer says, come on home. Here's Lonnie Smith's throw, and he slides in safely. Sandberg takes second.
At 65 years old, and you just heard Bob Costas with the highlights of Ryan Sandberg, who was the Hall of Fame second baseman for the Chicago Cubs, who had been battling cancer for about the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And he had been doing well for a while. It had been in remission. He even made an announcement. It was around a year ago that things were going well. And last night, after the cancer had come back for a while and he was being treated for it, he passed away at the age of 65. So we thought we should acknowledge a player who, for many of us who grew up in the 80s, I was a Cardinals fan growing up. And I remember when I was young that the team we didn't like was the New York Mets,
mm-hmm.
because the Mets were good. The Keith Hernandez thing.
Pond scum.
The pond scum. The Mets are ponds. We didn't do Cubs or pond scum t-shirts. We didn't have those. We didn't have the, Mark the Cubs. You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
we didn't have those shirts.
Yeah.
It was all about the Mets. And I thought the Cubs Cardinals rivalry, at least to my memory, was a lot friendlier than it is now. You know, it was sort of that, yeah, kind of like big brother, little brother sort of thing between the two teams and the fan bases. Then it got a lot more, there was a lot more venom once we got to about the mid to late 90s.
You brought up a good point, too, though, where if you asked Cardinals fans in the 80s.
This is
maybe
my
get
experience.
Some people weigh in on this, 314-436-7900.
My memory of being a kid and watching those two teams play. And, you know, the Cardinals were really good. The Cubs were good in 84. Cardinals were good in 85, 87. You know, World Series appearances. Everybody knows that. My memory of that time was if you were to ask a Cardinals fan, if the Cardinals don't win the World Series, who would you like to see do it? My feeling was that three or four of the five people you would ask would say maybe the Cubs. Because there was a friendlier rivalry at that time. Again, it wasn't until the Dusty Baker, Tony La Russa era that things started to get a lot more tense between the two teams and two fan bases. But what I will say about Ryan Sandberg is I always remembered kind of liking the guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're supposed to not like your division rival opponents, the players on that team. And I always felt like I liked him, and I thought of him because he was a contemporary with Ozzie Smith. I always thought that'd have been a cool infield, you know, an all-star infield, and they did play together in all-star games, to have those two guys at second and short. And I thought that was always a very neat thing. And I had a couple of interactions with Sandberg, not a lot, did one interview with him, saw him in person another time and spoke to him. Very, very nice person. And it's one of those things when you grow up watching a player and he was a guy you were supposed to not like and he was on the other team. And then you finally meet that person later in life. It was one of those I don't want to say awestruck because it wasn't that. But you do think back on when you were a kid watching him play against your team. And you have a lot of, I think, and I did have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah. No.
And so it's sad because he was a good dude and cancer is awful. And I don't know. I feel really bad for my friends who are Cubs fans and loved Ryan Sandberg.
Yeah. And I agree. The people I've talked to, just from what I've heard as well, is that he was pretty well liked even from division rivals. Like it was different. It wasn't anything like the Mets. As you mentioned, he did have metastatic prostate cancer in January of 2024. 7 months later, he announced that he was cancer free, but in December announced that his cancer had returned and spread to other parts of his body. And just as a side note, I have seen that happen multiple times with a couple of family friends where you're fighting cancer and then it's gone and then it comes back worse or in different areas of the body. It's so pernicious that way. That's really, really tough. I guess they prepare you for that if you are clear of cancer in one spot, why they have those follow-up visits just saying this stuff can come back.
It has to be devastating to feel like, at least in the moment, you're past it, and then to have it come back and it's even worse. And I think Cardinals fans who were alive at the time and conscious of it. That 1984, that game in June that is now called the Sandberg game.
Yeah.
The one where Willie McGee hit for the cycle and the Cardinals still lost. And Sandberg hit home runs in the ninth inning and the 10th inning to win it. One of those great individual games. And you had two guys who, and Willie was my one or two top favorite Cardinal growing up, Ozzie being the other. To have him hit for the cycle and then have Sandberg hit those two home runs.
Yeah.
Just a remarkable individual middle of the summer baseball game. But our thoughts are with the Cubs family and Ryan Sandberg's family today. When we come back, we will talk Cardinals baseball with John Denton, Cardinals beat writer for MLB.com. Trade deadline is coming up on Thursday. We'll talk to John next on KMOX.
Sponson's 2-2 pitch. Strike three called on the inside corner, and that's a Redbird winner. Light it up in downtown St. Louis as the Cardinals take game one of the three-game series, 7-1 over the Miami Marlins.
Cardinals have a series that is ongoing with the Marlins at Busch Stadium. Game two of that series is tonight after winning last night. Matt Pauly's got the pregame show at 5:50, first pitch at 6:45, and it's all here on KMOX. Time to go to the guest line. Cardinals beat writer for MLB.com is John Denton, and he is with us now. How's it going, John?
Oh, it's going great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And we were just talking about Ryan Sandberg, who passed away. Before we get to Cardinals business, we were just talking about Sandberg in the Hall of Fame, passed away yesterday. You've covered baseball for a long time. It's just one of those guys that had respect from pretty much everybody around the league.
Yeah, definitely. You know, an all-world player and an all-world person from everything I've heard. You know, just a gentle, he was 6'4", he was big for a second baseman, but kind of a gentle giant. You know, he was nice to everyone off the field. He often looked like the everyday man, you know, a guy who just kind of could relate to anybody in Chicago. I think that's why he was such a big hit in Chicago. Not to mention he was a great baseball player. And, you know, he was a rival of the Cardinals, but he was never the bad guy, villain, enemy, because everybody respected him in baseball.
Yeah, it's very difficult to dislike him. Growing up watching the Cards play against him, it was just really hard to not like that guy. We were just talking about that Sandberg game, too. The one where he played against the Cardinals, hit those two home runs late, and Willie hit for the cycle in that one, and they still lost.
That's what I was about to mention. Willie McGee gets overlooked for what he did that game. Willie McGee had one of the best games in Cardinal history that day, but it's known as the Sandberg game. But, you know, I mean, you hit a tying home run off of Bruce Sutter in the ninth and then a tying home run off Bruce Sutter in the 11th. It's going to be known as the Ryan Sandberg game because we all know Bruce Sutter's a Hall of Fame reliever, one of the best to ever do it. So that was a classic memory. It's kind of, you know, bittersweet for the Cardinals because they didn't win that day, though.
The thing that we are all paying attention to this week, John, is the trade deadline and what the Cardinals might do. They've already traded Eric Fetty to the Braves for a player to be named or cash. That determination is made later. I think all of us kind of assume that another reliever is probably going to go here. Maybe it's Ryan Helsley. Maybe it's Phil Maton. If you had to guess what's going to happen in the next few days, what do you think it'll be?
Yeah, you know, the Cardinals' strong suit is the bullpen, and so there are a lot of teams calling. You know, there are a lot of teams in World Series bust mode. You know, the Phillies need to get over the hump and finally win a World Series. They've been trying to do this for like four straight years now. The Phillies' bullpen is a major weakness. They could use Ryan Helsley, they could use Phil Maton. They could use a guy like JoJo Romero, you know, a left-hander who came from the Phillies back in 2022. He's given up one run in a month. Phil Maton is second in the league in lowest average exit velocity. He's fourth in the league in strikeout rate, and he's a guy who throws 89 miles an hour, but his curveball is elite, elite, elite. And, you know, any team in the league could use Ryan Helsley. The Cardinals are getting a lot of calls from the Toronto Blue Jays, the team that has the best record in baseball. They need help in the bullpen. So, you know, the Cardinals are going to get a lot of calls for all those guys in the bullpen. You know, I really think, and Ryan Helsley himself even thinks, you know, he's not going to be here by the end of the week. And that kind of crushes him because he's the longest tenured Cardinal. He's been here since he was drafted by the organization in 15. You know, he's been, this is all he knows. It's a little bit heartbreaking for him because he doesn't want to leave, but he knows how the game's played.
There was a report from John Morosi earlier today. In fact, it was within the last hour that Nolan Arenado, his name has come up in talks with the Astros, that the Cardinals have been talking things over. And of course, Houston had interest in him during the offseason. He chose not to go there. At this point, according to Morosi, no momentum toward the deal or toward a deal. But is it likely that Arenado is traded before we get to Thursday?
You know, I thought that the chances were dying of that because Nolan has had a rough July. But talking to people in his camp, talking to people around Nolan, they believe that the likelihood is that he will be moved at this deadline. If you look at it, Chris, I mean, there are probably nine teams that are looking for a third baseman. Three of them are in the Cardinals division. The Cubs want a third baseman. The Brewers, the Reds, they're all looking for third basemen. Meanwhile, you got the Tigers and the Mariners. You know, those are teams that need third basemen. So because there's so many teams, everybody wants Eugenio Suarez, the third baseman for the Diamondbacks, the guy who had four home runs earlier this year. Everybody wants him. But when you miss on him, teams are likely to come to the Cardinals and look for a third baseman. I mean, the Astros, Paredes is probably out for the season after tearing his hamstring. They need help at third baseman. If they're going to be a serious contender, they've got to get an everyday third baseman. So it makes sense that Houston's calling again about Nolan Arenado because, you know, they had huge hopes of getting him back in December, and I don't think they've ever really abandoned that idea.
When it comes to trade deadline trades, are some of the players that maybe have no trade clauses or at least have a limit on their teams, do they change their mind? Do they loosen the rules sometimes at this point in the season than how they approach it during the offseason?
Yeah, Amy, that's, you know, the John Mozeliak has gone back. I mean, one of the things that I tweeted yesterday, John Mozeliak and Sonny Gray had a conversation recently to find out if Sonny still wants to be in St. Louis. A lot of times players say in the offseason, you know, I want to stay, I want to be a part of this. But when you go through losing, it beats you up. And, you know, you get older in your career, you get later in your career, all you want to do is win. Nolan Arenado has $300 million in the bank. All he cares about now is being a part of a championship team. You know, remarkably, in 13 years, Nolan Arenado's won one playoff game. He came to St. Louis. He was supposed to be the missing piece that were going to help the Cardinals win it all. He hasn't won a playoff game in St. Louis. So you get later in your career, you start looking around, you want to play for a winner, and, you know, maybe you had one idea of, hey, I want to be a part of it in St. Louis, but later in the season, you go back to these guys, and maybe their thought has changed. Maybe Wilson Contreras at some point wants to play for a contender instead of being in St. Louis. Maybe Sonny Gray's mind changes at some point. Maybe Nolan Arenado picks a team that he wouldn't have picked in the offseason.
This question has been asked a lot leading into the deadline, and knowing the organization is in a transition from John Mozeliak as the president of baseball operations to Chaim Bloom, and people want to know, how involved is Bloom in whatever they're going to do here this week?
I think he will have a tremendous say in what's going on. Obviously, he's the guy who's going to have to deal with the future. He's going to have a say in everything. You know, the Cardinals don't make any moves in a vacuum. Like, it's not a one-person decision. There are, you know, multiple people sitting at the table helping with that decision. And Chaim has a seat at that table, and Chaim has a strong voice, and they would be foolish not to listen to him because, you know, he's built successful teams in the past. It's going to be his show in the future. He has institutional knowledge of the Rays and the Red Sox and even Philadelphia Phillies. So it would be foolish not to listen to him, and I think he's going to have a very strong say in what happens at the deadline.
What did you make of left fielder Ivan Herrera out there? I thought his post game was pretty hilarious, how he thought the ball, when he had to make that catch out in left field, he thought it was 30 rows deep, and he was backing up, and then he had to run forward to get it.
Yeah, the pitcher thought it was gone because of the way he saw Andre Pallante thought it was gone because of the way he saw Herrera.
That's right.
But, I mean, Herrera pointed out afterwards, he said, look, John Jay has taught me, run to the spot and then you're under it. Don't try to catch it while you're moving. So he actually did exactly what he was taught. But it was, you know, the coolest moment of the night was to see him catch that ball. The air comes out of his lungs and he lets out a smile. So that first fly ball is, you know, it's scary, especially in a major league stadium. Maybe you catch it in spring training, it's no big deal. But you get in a major league stadium with three decks and 25,000 people there. He said, you know, he put his hand on his chest and his heart was beating through his jersey. He could feel it moving. So
I love it.
They're not going to play out there every day. It was just done to give Alec Burleson the day off. They've got to find a position for Yvonne Herrera because he hits the ball too well. Yeah. That bat's got to be in the lineup every day, but he can't just be exclusively a DH. He's got to learn to play another position.
Yeah, this is maybe the most important job for the Cardinals coaching staff and Ollie Marmol is to continue for the rest of the year to get a look at as many players as possible, gather as much data as they possibly can so they can make decisions for 2026. So getting him out there is important. Getting Nolan Gorman out there is important. What else do you see as being important for them in these final 2 months, knowing that they are 3.5 games out of a wild card spot? So even if they do make trades, there's always that, I guess, very distant possibility they could still be in September interesting as a team.
Yeah, Chris, you know, the last night kind of gave a glimpse of what's coming for the next 2 months. I mean, like you said, they've got to get Nolan Gorman back from, you know, he's out with a back injury. He's starting a rehab assignment tonight in Springfield. They've got to get him back. And if Nolan Arenado's gone, he needs to play third base every day. They've got to get Lars Nootbaar back. Lars is starting a rehab in Springfield tomorrow, Wednesday night. You need to find out if Kyle Leahy could be a starter. You need to find out if Kyle Leahy could be a closer. So many things. By the middle of August, you're going to see the top prospects in the organization. J.J. Weatherholt's probably going to be here. Jimmy Crooks, you know, the Cardinals have about 8 catchers on the roster, but I'm not sure they have the catcher of the future on the roster. But they are loaded at the catcher position in the minor leagues. You probably need to get Jimmy Crooks here by September to see what you got going in the offseason with him at the catcher position. So there's a lot of answers still to be revealed. You know, maybe they're not on that championship track. Maybe they don't make the playoffs this year. But there are a lot of big questions that need answered going down the stretch.
All right, John Denton, as always, we appreciate talking with you here. And we'll be paying attention with the trade deadline at 5 o'clock on Thursday. So just a couple of days here for the Cardinals to make their move or moves. And we will be paying attention. Thank you very much, John.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Cardinals writer for MLB.com is John Denton with us here.
I loved how nervous Herrera was because I feel like just the pressure of being out there and just your catcher and then now, yeah, we'll throw it out in left field. That's a totally different view. I know these guys are professional athletes, but I have no depth perception. So to me, they say hitting a baseball is the hardest feat in sports. I think catching a really high fly ball is second hardest.
You better have depth perception if you're a catcher because you need to know if that ball's 60 feet from you or one.
That's why I don't play baseball.
Because it'll hit you in the face. You got a mask on, but it still hurts. You can get a concussion that way.
You're right. You're very, you sound like a parent right now.
That's right. And I've brought the orange slices.
Were you good at catching high fly balls?
No,
you weren't.
I was good at pop-ups.
Really?
I played in the infield when I played.
But a line drive is way easier to catch than a pop-up.
Oh, super. Pop-ups, you know, when people settle under them,
yeah.
If they're not really experienced,
yeah.
Where they think the ball is going to land, it's always like a foot behind you or 2 feet behind you. So they tell you to go where you think it's going to go and then back up a couple of steps.
Do they?
Yeah.
Because I will say when there are foul balls in the stands at Busch Stadium, I think it's going to hit me and then it like is on the opposite side of the stadium. I just can't tell where it is at all.
I would like, but as we say goodbye in this break or in this segment, I'm very disappointed with all the people who went to the Savannah Bananas game. I expected way more caught foul balls There were like two. There were multiple foul balls.
Yeah.
Almost all of them dropped.
Unbelievable.
We have to do better as a city.
We should. Interesting baseball note. I was running with a buddy this morning, and I brought up the St. Louis conversation. Why do you live in St. Louis? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Is it a love-hate relationship? What's so great about St. Louis? And we had a good conversation, and we're going to continue that at 11:30. So we do want to hear from you, 314-436-7900. And, of course, I brought up the pros that I had about it's such a great place to raise a family. There are so many things to do as far as sports and arts. And the food scene is insane. The music scene, I mean, we've got some incredible local musicians. We bring in some great acts. And so I just think it's such a great place. You get kind of that, like we said, big city feel, a big city amenities with a small town feel. And if you come from a smaller city like Tulsa or Paducah and you don't have any pro teams, of course, St. Louis has those big city pro teams. But the buddy that I was running with today lived in Athens, Georgia for a long time. And in the 90s, he said he would go to the Braves games. And the 90s Braves into the early 2000s, those were good teams.
Yeah, mid-90s.
Those were really good teams. And he said one thing that always struck him is that it felt like there were more Cardinals fans than Braves fans in the park. And he said, and again, he goes, maybe I just happened to go to those games where there were a lot of Cardinals fans. But he was basically talking about that strong tie. Cardinals fans travel. Cardinals fans are everywhere. There's that strong tie to the Cardinals themselves, but also to the city of St. Louis. And you represent when you're there. So he said it was always fun going to Braves games, even though the Cardinals were not that great at that time.
Well, for a long time, if you lived down that direction, that part of the country, you probably were a Cardinals fan. So I think it takes a generation or two to turn that over. You're going to have younger fans who become fans of whatever team shows up at the time. Like if you're five or six, you're a fan of whatever's in your immediate background or, you know, your neighborhood. But a lot of people were Cardinals fans down in that part of the country for a long time. So I think it probably took the Braves a little bit of time to take hold, I think,
because was
down
that,
there.
Was it in the 60s when the Braves, I think it was the 60s, right, when the Braves showed up?
I don't remember exactly. Sounds about right.
It was before your time.
It was before my time.
Yeah. But at any rate, it was pretty interesting. And I do feel St. Louis people, you see a lot of St. Louis Cardinals hats when you travel abroad,
sure.
Whether it's Hawaii or Switzerland or Canada. You also see Yankees hats, right? I feel like the most common baseball caps abroad are Yankees and Cardinals. And Yankees could be true Yankees fans, but it could also be
I bet it's Dodgers. I bet it's Yankees and Dodgers. Abroad?
I haven't seen Dodgers. I've seen a lot of Yankees. But again, I'm not that I'm the best traveled person. But like in Switzerland, I saw a couple of Yankees hats. But what's funny is, I don't know, those Yankees hats are sold as fashion.
Of course.
So you know what I mean?
Of course.
So
kind of like
no one's selling Cardinals hats as fashion. If you see a Cardinals hat, it's a St. Louisan. A Yankees hat could just be a fashion statement.
And I do think Dodgers hats are probably like that. Mm-hmm. And for a while in the early to mid 90s when the White Sox had that black old, it was a black hat with the white old English logo. That was like in the hip hop world, that was a huge thing. So it became pretty widespread. So you don't see that a whole lot in baseball, but you're right about the Yankees for sure. It's Chris and Amy on KMOX, and there is a documentary called Catching Bullets, and it premieres next month on August 14th at a theater in Pagedale. We're going to talk to Darren Seals, community leader with the Sankofa Unity Center, next. He's going to come up and talk about that movie when we come back.